For the week of May 17th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. I am Karen Woodward, stuck in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jay Sperling Reich, and I'm in Cannes. And we're joined today also by Michael Giltz, who is here in Cannes as well, covering the festival for the Huffington Post.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, Michael.
Now, we're not recording under our normal circumstances or with our regular equipment, and Michael and I are both in the press office here at the Palais de Festival in Cannes, France. So it might be a little noisy, and the audio quality might not be what it regularly is. It might not sound as good, but if you bear with us, I'm sure you'll enjoy the rest of the show.
So guys, tell us about Cannes.
Well, I'll let Michael go first.
It's quiet.
It is very quiet.
I've been coming to Cannes for 10 years. I've never seen the streets so quiet. It's easier to get around. There are fewer journalists, fewer market people. There are fewer billboards promoting upcoming movies. I mean, there's just fewer parties. There's fewer of everything except actual films in the competition. That's as interesting and good a slate as we've had in a number of years. So for what we really care about, getting to go to see movies, it's fine. But for the market and the health of the industry and the excitement and the attention, it's not so good.
I would agree with that. There was actually a story on the Huffington Post written by Rex Weiner, who talked about how the trades aren't coming to the festival in droves the way they used to, and the trades being Variety and the Hollywood Reporter. They're covering it from both Los Angeles and Cannes.
Is this, I assume, because of the economy, right?
Yes.
Absolutely.
It's also because a lot of people feel, at least in North America, that it's just not worth it to cover Cannes anymore. It's an international festival. It's been going on 62 years. None of the films that have won the Palme d'Or, which is Cannes' top prize, have ever really done well in the States. So a lot of North American editors and media outlets just feel that it's not worth it anymore.
I disagree a little bit, because in the last decade, we've seen Hollywood finally wake up a bit to Cannes and realize that they've got the world's media here all at once and use the festival not by putting films in competition, but by creating a lot of excitement for The Lord of the Rings, showing it to people early, letting them know the movies were going to be really great, promoting animated films like Shrek and this year Up. And they've been launching the Da Vinci Code last year, and they've been really smart at realizing, hey, why not take advantage of Cannes? When you throw a big party and you put a big, you know, summer blockbuster out there, people know that's just to have fun. And when it's not in competition, it's not a risk. And that they can use Cannes to promote their movies. And that's been growing and growing in the last few years.
Do you cover other film festivals beside Cannes? Do you go to Sundance and Telluride as well?
Me, no, I don't. I feel like if I was going to go to another festival, it would be Toronto. But Sundance, there's no point, because every newspaper in the country sends someone to Sundance. And I'm a freelance writer, and I need to go places where I can be where the newspapers aren't. So I go to Cannes because I know that the Denver Post and the Vancouver Sun and the Des Moines Register aren't sending a reporter to Cannes. And if there's a story here that they might want, like Bowling for Columbine, which I did for the Denver Post, I know I've gotten in with them by being here. I can offer something that they don't have otherwise. At Sundance, you know, they got a million people there.
Well, now,
can you tell me a little bit about, like, the day of a journalist at Cannes?
It starts really early.
I am not a morning person at all. In this festival, every day there's a film at 8:30 in the morning that you have to be there by 8 a.m. to get a decent seat. And it's exhausting, because you can watch movies all day long till 10, or even starting at 12 at night to 2 in the morning in the next few days. So you can see 5-6 movies in a day. And if you're also trying to file stories, it's exhausting. But luckily, Cannes has used to send places like the Hollywood Reporter would send 2 or 3 reporters. They'd have one person do parties, one person do the market, and one person cover the festival. And now 2 of those people aren't here anymore, so you have one person doing 3 things poorly, perhaps. Luckily, I don't care about the party, so all I do is just go to the movies.
So you don't go to the parties at all?
Absolutely not. It's a total waste of time. I can't get any work out of it. It's not fun. All you do is shove in among a million other people to try to get a free warm beer and look at the celebrities who are in another area off, you know, cut off by the velvet rope. You know, what's the point?
No, so it's totally
boring. I would agree with that.
But you said yourself, though, that Cannes kind of has more kind of, you know, flash to it than the other ones. So if I'm a journalist... Go ahead.
It has a lot more flash, and that helps bring attention to the festival and to the Hollywood movies, but you don't have to go to the actual party in order to mention that. And, you know, if you're covering parties and gossip and who's there, then, yeah, you got to do that. But I'm focusing on the movie. So happily, I don't have to spend – that's a full-time job. You've got to fight to get a ticket in the morning or in the afternoon, go to the hotels, beg for a ticket, get in line, go to the party. Sometimes they're on boats or yachts, which sounds great, but then you're trapped on the boat or the yacht. And if you want to leave, you can't because you're in the middle of the water. So the parties become nightmares, really.
I hope you
there's the villa parties.
There's the what? The villa parties?
The villa's parties, yeah.
I want to hear more
parties
about
up in the hills.
Michael, what's one of the favorite movies that you've seen so far?
I think everyone would say Un Prophet is the big early hit of the festival so far. It's a French film about a young guy who's sort of naive, who somehow gets sent to jail for 6 years. We don't know for what crime, I don't think. And he's immediately, you know, beaten up, attacked, forced to, you know, he's being forced to kill somebody in jail. And you don't know whether he's going to get chewed up and spat out or whether he's become evil or whether he might somehow be able to survive and keep his humanity intact. And it's a 2.5-hour movie and it's just gripping, great fun. It was a really good movie.
Well, great fun in a certain way.
Picked up? Did anybody buy it?
They will.
Okay.
What about you, Sproul?
I liked A Prophet. I also liked Up, of course. And I also liked... I thought Fish Tank was pretty good. We should probably say who directed A Prophet.
I have no idea.
Audiard. Philippe Audiard. He directed the film The Beat That My Heart Skipped, which is a remake of James Toback's Fingers, and which was far superior to James Toback's Fingers, though I know people like that film. He also directed Read My Lips, which was a very fun thriller about a woman and a man who get involved in intrigue. And those were two really good, strong, interesting movies, and this film, Un Prophet, is a major leap forward for him from those.
I also like Jane Campion's Bright Star. It's about John Keats and his love affair, or unrequited love affair with Fanny Braun.
That's one of the movies that the British and the European critics seemed to like a bit, but most of the Americans didn't. I wasn't a big fan of it. I thought it was beautifully shot, beautifully edited, beautifully acted, and I felt nothing. It's certainly Jane Campion's most solid effort since The Piano. And then she's had other interesting films like, what was that called? Holy Kinky Smoke, or what was that called? Film.
Hideous Kinky.
Kinky film. Hideous Kinky, that's right. And Portrait of a Lady had its interest, I suppose. But this is certainly her most traditional.
But I think it also was without heart.
Yes, absolutely. And that was certainly a problem with it. This is more traditional, but without heart. And I found it a little disappointing because I had prepared heart. I had read John Keats' poetry. I'm reading a biography of him. So it was all primed to like the movie. And I like Ben Whishaw, who's the British actor who stars as John Keats. He's about a foot taller than John Keats, who was 5 feet tall, nothing. 5 feet, nothing. He was very short, even for that time. And I like Ben Whishaw, but I didn't feel like I was watching a genius on screen. I mean, I didn't feel like he was portraying this genius. And the period where we're watching him is the period where he's creating some of his greatest poetry. And that didn't come across at all to me.
Hmm. What else is
there? I also liked Taking Woodstock, but not a lot of people like that film.
What did
you
like
about
it?
It's a new Ang Lee film. It's based on a book. I just thought it was light and airy.
It was certainly light. I'm a big Ang Lee fan. I really love Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Sense and Sensibility, and Ice Storm. I mean, he's literally made some of my favorite films of all time. And Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was one of my great experiences at Cannes. And so I was really looking forward to this film, hoping to be a rebound a little bit from Lust, Caution, and The Hulk. And I didn't think he did it. It was very slight. As somebody else said, Ang Lee is very square. He's a very square guy. And he perhaps didn't have the right sense and sensibility to capture Woodstock.
Yeah, that's plus, a strange choice.
Well, plus it's about a closeted gay guy. And the whole he hasn't told his parents he's gay. He knows he's gay. He's happy with being gay. But he hasn't told his crusty old Jewish parents that he's gay. And the whole movie is about the weekend of Woodstock and opening up and freeing yourself and taking acid and free love. And it's just everybody expands their horizons. And yet the guy doesn't even tell his dad or his mom that he's gay. So it felt a little bit like, well, golly, he didn't do that much, did he? You know, if you're going to have a movie about a repressed gay guy who gets unrepressed, surely he should say something about it to his parents.
The main character is played by Dimitri Martin.
Hey, Sperling, you sent me a clip for a Mariah Carey movie. Is it premiering there, Precious, or Push, or whichever they decided to call it?
It's called Precious. This is Michael talking. It's called Precious, and the name, the novel, Push, it's by Sapphire. Fire, Brooklyn, a lesbian Brooklyn writer, and they've changed the name to Precious because it just makes more sense. That debuted at Sundance and was a big success there, review-wise, but it didn't get a distributor right away, and the New York Times wrote an article saying, this movie's unmarketable. We like it, but no one's going to ever want to see it. They made it sound like it was torture. Which is crazy because they liked it and it got a ton of great reviews. And it has since been picked up by Lionsgate.
It's a really good film.
And will be out in November. And it's here to reach the international press.
It's a very good film.
Really? Is Mariah Carey any good at it?
Yeah. Actually, she's fantastic in it.
Good for her.
Unrecognizable, but fantastic.
What about Lenny Kravitz?
She's dowdy. He has a very small role. He plays a male nurse, and he's fine in it. Monique is the real standout in the supporting cast. Monique, the comedian who I like a lot and has been good in other dramatic roles. She has a really good dramatic role, and Sperling said to me that he bets she could get an Oscar nomination, and that's not out of the question.
Huh.
That is true. Why don't we take a quick listen to the clip?
Play it.
I knew Lee was doing the movie Push. I had read Push like years ago. A friend of mine gave me the book, and it changed my life, literally. I don't know how many of you have actually read Sapphire's book, but it's intense, and it is life-changing. And so for me, I was like, you're doing Push? I mean, me and my friends who had read the book were like, I can't believe he's doing Push. We're so excited knowing Lee and knowing that material. So when we actually talked about it, like we said, it was a last-minute thing, and I just said, let me just kind of peel layers away of who the world thinks I am, of who even I personally feel I am as, you know, as a performer, as anything, and really truly become this woman who has a large responsibility of kind of, which in a way she is the audience. She is that shocked person who hears about what goes on and has to kind of bare her soul because she's hearing something that is so horrific that she's never heard before. And I think a lot of people feel that way when they see the movie. So in order, why, how do I think I could do it? Because I know that there's a creative side of me that needs to do work like this. And I trust Lee so much that I felt that there was no way we wouldn't pull something out that we would both be proud of.
I find it intriguing that Mariah Carey is getting good reviews for this, that she's, you know, supposed to be fantastic. I saw Glitter. I actually worked the Glitter premiere and actually saved her seat at that premiere. I felt
awesome.
So sorry for her because she seems like such a nice, she seems like such a nice, you know, young lady. And it's actually, it surprises me that she's good, but I say good for her.
I was, I had a funny story. I went to the press conference that they were holding for Precious. And I was arriving late because I was at a screening. So I was arriving at 1:30. They had lunch at 12:30, and then the press conference was supposed to start at 1:30. And I figured, Mariah Carey, she won't be on time. And as I got there, there were just a scrum of photographers still at the entrance waiting. And also at the hotel across the street. So I figured Mariah Carey hasn't shown up yet, which is not a big surprise. She'll probably be there any minute. And all the photographers kept telling each other, Mariah Carey, Mariah Carey. So I stood there and I waited. I figured, well, they won't start anyway till she shows up. And finally, 45 minutes later, Mariah Carey comes over from across the street. And then, I mean, she's just surrounded. It's just like, you know, a little Chavita. I mean, it's just absolutely out of control. 50, 100 photographers, people climbing onto signs to try to take pictures of her, women getting crushed against the barricade, literally. And I'm videotaping it and having fun. And she's wearing a little scarf and she's got a guy with her. I'm not sure if it was Lenny Kravitz or her husband, Nick Cannon. But they scurry through the people, finally get inside and run downstairs. And everybody's screaming her name. And then I go downstairs and walk in. I follow her. I'm the only one who can go downstairs. They don't have credentials. And she's already seated at the table. They're all talking, and the press conference is over. And I'm like, Sperling, what's going on? Did she answer, like, one question? He said, no, she's been here for 45 minutes talking to us. And the woman I'd seen was a body double used to distract the paparazzi. And they made all of them wait. Somehow, I don't know how she got there through a secret tunnel or arrived an hour early, undiva-like. But she was there on time and professional, and her body double behaved like a diva and kept the photographers waiting in the rain for 45 minutes. And then, you know, just put them all on a Mary Goose chase. So I thought that was great.
Good for her.
And actually, Michael has a post about this on the Huffington Post, which we'll put in the show notes.
So what else have you liked, Sperling? Think of the Lars von Trier film tonight that we just saw, Antichrist.
Oh my God. I can't even begin to tell you how interesting and difficult and unwatchable that movie is. And this is coming from somebody who loves Lars von Trier.
Did you think he was just being shocking to be shocking? It's a hard movie to discuss without spoiling plot points for people, but the basic thrust of the film is a man and a wife who are making love, and tragically their child falls out of a window in the very first scene and dies while they're making love, and they don't notice. And, of course, they're guilt-ridden and filled with sorrow. And he doesn't like her psychiatrist because she's overwhelmed with grief, and she's heavily medicated, and he's not happy, and he's a therapist. So Willem Dafoe decides to take his wife to their cabin in the woods, which they call Eden, and he's going to give her therapy himself, which of course is something you're not supposed to do. And a friend of ours who really liked the film said the movie is not about hatred for women, because Lars von Trier is famously derided as misogynistic by some people, but he says the film is about the hubris of man in the face of the mystery of woman, that this man should not have tried to practice therapy on a relative, which of course is absolutely true, and boy is it true in this case. And it's a
what
good
happens?
Theory.
Yeah, well, it does not end well.
Craziness ensues. And it's a perfectly good way of thinking about the film. The problem is that it's far more coherent than anything you'll actually see in the film, which contains fairy tale elements like talking foxes and genital mutilation and all sorts of other fun stuff.
Oh, yeah, fun stuff.
And what Michael means by genital mutilation is close-up graphic genital mutilation.
Ugh.
It's not done as a shadow play.
Oh,
you get to actually see genital mutilation.
Yes.
I looked away.
Well, now, what did you think of... I know that we kind of got off of Precious, but what did you think of Lenny Kravitz? Because we have a clip to play from his interview.
Well, Lenny Kravitz is a cool artist. I cover a lot of rock and roll music, a lot of music as well as movies and TV and books and theater. And he's a pretty fun guy. I like him as a musician. He was fine. It was a very small, undemanding role, and he was fine in it. I didn't think, oh my gosh, I want to see him again in another role, but he was good.
But he's sort of well known for
Lenny
being
Kravitz
the maniac, and he says in this clip, which Sperling will play in a second, that he was happy that he was unrecognized.
Oh yeah, well, he's certainly in Nursing Scrubs, and I mean his talent. I wasn't sure about. I didn't think, wow, what a wonderful acting talent. But he certainly gets into the role.
Both Mariah Carey and Lenny Kravitz have smaller parts in Precious, and Lenny Kravitz was here in Cannes, and we can listen to a clip here.
Julian Schnabel introduced us at Mr. Chow one night. Lee said that he'd wanted to meet me and that he'd been trying to reach me to work with him in the past, but could never get through to me. We met, we discussed doing some films together. I didn't have time at the time, I was on tour. He said, I'm doing this film called, at the time, which was entitled Push, and I'd like you to come in and do this character, Nurse John. It's a small role, you've got 2 days, you can come in, let's knock this out, let's see how we feel working together. That's how it began. It was a very interesting process. It was very quick, but the thing that Lee wanted to do was make me disappear, starting with, you can't walk like that. You can't move like that. Your hand can't do that. You can't talk like that. And literally, in an hour, completely changed my whole vibe. As I found out, when people were screening the movie, they didn't even know it was me, which I found hard to believe. And I owe that to Lee. You know, for somebody who does his own thing, I make my own music, I write my own music, I produce my own music, I play all the instruments. I'm known as a control freak, as people like to put it. I just like to do what I do. It was really great to, first of all, do something that I don't normally do, which is acting. Completely give up all control, which is what I always have. And Lee, you know, brought this character out, and I'm grateful to have done it. I'm glad this is my first role.
So that's pretty much Ken. You know, while we mentioned at the opening that a lot of journalists aren't here, one journalist who is Roger Ebert.
That's right.
Really? How's he?
You know, I actually am back and forth between, I'm based in New York, but also go back and forth to Champaign, Illinois, and that's Roger Ebert's hometown. And so I go to Ebert Fest every year. So I've been seeing Roger throughout his illness sort of as he gets better and worse. Last year, Roger was was a little worse for wear. I mean, 2 years ago, he was worse for wear. Last year, he couldn't even make it. And this year at Eberfest, he looked really perky, really in good spirits. He's using a computer to talk to people. He can type in text. And that was really positive to see. And I thought, wow, he looks like he's chirpy and getting around, and he might just go to Con and join up here at Con. He's at the film screenings. You know, he's got, you know, he's slow to walk and he can't talk, but he can communicate through his lovely wife, Chaz, who's a very fun lady. And he's here, and it's awesome to see him, because when I come to Cannes expecting to see Roger Ebert, you know, he wrote one of the great books about Cannes, and he's just a fixture of the festival.
All right, parting thoughts about Cannes?
Yeah, we have another. We've got a long ways to go. We've got 2/3 of the competition films. I've already seen two or three movies that'll probably be in my best of the year list. So that's already a really good festival for me.
All right.
Just as
what
far
are
as
they? What are they?
Loves movies. I really liked Police Adjective, which is the new film by the director of 1208 East to Bucharest. It's a pure art house film. It's, you know, it's got long slow passages, but it builds to a really fascinating conclusion about life in the post-Ceausescu Romania, and I certainly really loved A Prophet. And there's one or two other good movies in there that I haven't made up my mind yet, but I'm going to check out. You know,
Mother.
They have a reprisal. Mother for an acting award, perhaps. What about you, Sperling?
And Samson and Delilah.
Yes, that's a terrific. Thank you for mentioning that. That was one I was really looking forward to. It's Warwick Thornton is this Australian cinematographer, and it's his film directorial debut. He wrote it, he directed it, he edited it, he shot it, he scored it, and I think he catered it, but I'm not sure about that. And it's almost a silent film. It's set in the Aboriginal community of Australia. And for long stretches of the film, people don't talk, but it's not, attention isn't brought to it, and it's just very natural. And it's beautifully done, and there's a reason for it as you watch the film and you figure it out. But it's beautifully shot and edited and done, and it's clearly the first debut from a really talented guy.
Well, we should probably wrap up Cannes because we have so many stories to cover this week.
Yeah, and we're going to have to make each of these stories. We're not going to be able to talk at great length about any of them. Our podcast is going to be 2 hours long.
Well, maybe we'll just pick a few big stories.
Okay.
Who won the weekend?
Movie-wise. Am I supposed to check this stuff? I assume it was Star Trek.
It was it was a fight between Star Trek and Angels and Demons. The last I heard, Angels and Demons had edged it out. But
$48 million. Made $48 million. Yep.
That's much lower than the first run. I think they made $77 million its opening weekend. The Da Vinci Code.
You know, maybe I'm just not, you know, in the right places, but I haven't seen a lot of press for Angels and Demons.
You might not be impressed with it, but overseas it made $104.3 million in 96 territories.
I haven't seen a lot of press for it.
And you're right about that, because they didn't do it because they were worried about another Vatican controversy, but this time the Vatican laid low. I mean, last year at this time, the Da Vinci Code played at Cannes, and you had nuns crawling up the red carpet in protest. So they were worried, and they figured the movie would sell itself, and they didn't need to do a lot of press. And they're right. Put Tom Hanks on a few TV shows. You know, it'll sell itself, and it has. It's made $150 million worldwide in its opening weekend. It's going to be fine. But you're right, there's very little press on it, and that's because they were a little scared.
Well, Star Trek almost beat it out. It made $43 million, dropping only 46%. It's racked up $147.6 million to date. X-Men Origins came in third with $14.8 million. And it's made 151.1 to date. 151 point million, of course.
And not much more to come.
That is correct.
So how is Ghosts of Girlfriends Past doing?
I know, your favorite movie.
Michael, I'm like the chick flick queen. I will see anything that is a chick flick. And I saw this movie, and it was so awful. But it did so, you know... It did pretty well its second week because it went down, what, Sperling, like 14% or something? Like really
small? Oh, that's great.
It was in the 30s. Really, I think it was the 30%.
Yeah, but it was – I'm keeping abreast of this.
Rory Brewer over at Sony is downplaying the $48 million being disappointing. He tells The Hollywood Reporter, "We never expected it to perform to the level of the Da Vinci Code."
Why?
But why not? It should have.
Yeah.
And by the way, Star Trek's second weekend of 40, what? How much was it, the second weekend, Sperling?
43 million.
That is about 13 million more than the second biggest Star Trek opening of all time, which was Star Trek First Contact. So its second weekend is bigger than any other Star Trek film opening in history. So this is this isn't just a reboot of the film. This has taken the series to an entirely new level.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're already planning the sequel.
Oh, of course.
I, of course, have not seen this movie yet. But Sperling, I am planning on seeing it this week.
It's worth seeing.
I know, I know.
As far as Ghost of Girlfriends Past, it's not even listed here in The Hollywood Reporter.
Oh, yeah. Fell out of the top 10. That's what I'm talking about. Go Matthew McConaughey.
He can pick them.
He really can pick them. All right. Okay, moving on. There was an article about MGM, Fights to Survive. Nikki Fink, who I follow fairly religiously, was talking about this.
And this was in Deadline Hollywood.
I know pretty much only what she has said, which is that pretty much that. They're fighting to survive, and Mary Parent wants them to free up cash so that she can go ahead and make movies.
Well, they're faced with $3.7 billion in debt, which is due in July of 2002. They're going to pay $250 million in interest alone by April 2010, according to Deadline Hollywood.
I don't feel so bad about my credit card debt anymore.
Yeah, me neither, right?
You guys have credit card debt?
Oh, yeah.
Did you just ask me if I have credit card debt?
I'm an American. Of course I do.
I shop. Of course I do.
The MGM hasn't really existed terrifically well in many years, has it? I mean, it's been decades where they've been up and down. It's sort of just a shingle, a glorified shingle in my mind. It hasn't been a major studio in decades. Yeah, I used to work. I got my first job at Premiere Magazine. I remember doing stories about MGM being just a catalog and, you know, on its lifeline back in 1987, 91, 92.
Well, what I'm wondering is whether it will change things is the release of Fame, which is September of this year.
It could.
Yeah, I mean, it looks interesting. They've got a pretty decent cast. The trailer, I thought, was really fun. And I'd see it.
I'll definitely see it. I love the TV show. I'm still waiting for that to come out on DVD. It's probably a music rights issue.
I can't believe it hasn't. I love the TV show.
It's a music rights issue, I'm sure. And they're smart to keep it away from American Idol. Release it in the fall.
Yeah, but they could play off of American Idol, the popularity of it, right?
They could, but I think it's better. It's sort of overload, you know, when you have two or three of something, it feels, you know, you're watching the real thing on TV. Maybe you wouldn't be as excited by Fame in the theaters, but without when American Idol's off the air, you're sort of hungering for it, and then you go see Fame.
Yeah, I would
program
release
it
next week after Adam Lambert wins American Idol.
You mean Chris Allen?
No, I mean Adam Lambert.
No, you mean Chris Allen. I've been rooting for Chris for about 8-10 weeks now because he's damn cute, and he's really been he's been getting better and better every week. He's really talented.
No. The only thing he has going for him is that he's cute. He has the talent of a turnip. No way. Adam Lambert is a star.
Adam Lambert is, if I want to be negative, I'd say he's a one-trick pony, but I think he is talented, and I think they're both going to have successful albums. I think it's a year like Ruben Studdard and Clay Aiken, where you're not going to lose. I think Alison Irohita, the oldest teenager in the world, could have a successful album five or six years down the road. But
I think she'll have a successful album next year.
Well, you know what I mean. As she gets a little bit older, she'll look a little more natural when she's singing Bonnie Raitt. And
yeah, it's true.
Well, you guys have been talking about American Idol, a subject that bores me to no end.
I voted, okay? I never used to watch American Idol. I'm so into it this season. I voted.
I voted too. For Chris Allen.
Yeah, I voted to take it off the air. Well, I'm looking here at MGM's lineup, not to get off American Idol, but I'm looking at MGM's lineup, and I see that they're releasing Poltergeist and The Three Stooges and Red Dawn.
That's sad.
Are they doing anything that hasn't been made before?
About the Three Stooges remake?
I don't remember reading about that. Sean Penn is in it?
Well,
yeah.
He's brooded about
Sean
it.
Penn,
yeah,
what, Benicio del Toro?
Benicio del Toro, that's right.
And who's the third?
I'm looking it up right now. I forget, but that's—I don't think that's filming yet. So, do they have an actual release date for that film? Because I think it's just—they
say next year, quarter three or four. Yeah, no, it hasn't. So.
Well, I didn't mean to derail the American Idol chatter.
No,
that's
not
okay
at all.
Because I mean, obviously, Michael is wrong, and he will realize that on Wednesday.
not if my speed dial has anything to say about it.
I want to talk about the upfronts because my sister's got a client who had a TV show. Happy about that.
Oh, which one?
Happy Town. John Patrick Amadori. So we're celebrating in my household.
That's awesome.
I know. But Scrubs was picked up.
That is ridiculous. That is so ridiculous.
Zach Braff has only come back for 6 episodes.
Talk about the network
they've made
being
the same.
Desperate.
Yeah, they said, well, oh, I know. And they made the same thing to Sarah Chalke, supposedly, that 6 episodes. Although I read somewhere recently that she said she would come back for all episodes if she was at.
Is that how you pronounce her name? Sarah Chalke?
I thought it was. Is it Chalk?
I have no idea.
I have no idea, but she can't be that busy.
Well,
she's in How I Met Your Mother. Don't you watch that show? I mean, she's a recurring.
That's right.
I had
she's
no
a recurring
idea.
Character on that show. I like that show.
I love that show.
Is she still dating him on that show?
No. Well, I don't know. I mean, I haven't been able to watch it that much the past few weeks because I've got House and Gossip Girl, which are both on at that time. So I'm kind
of like...
You
need 2 DVRs.
I need 2 DVRs and I only have one. So I have to... Yeah, it makes my life very difficult. Mondays at 8.
I believe her art came to a beginning, middle, and end. I don't think she's... popping in so much because they sort of had a finale to the end of their relationship. She could always pop back in, and maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, no,
but I
she left him at the altar, which was awesome. But
yeah.
I read somewhere, I don't know if you've been watching it recently. I read somewhere that there's a hint that she actually might be the mother.
Oh, I thought whenever they introduce a new romantic character, don't they usually say, "But this isn't her," or did they leave it mysterious with Sarah?
They left it mysterious.
There you go. Would she be a? Which do you like her for him?
No. I always thought that he was going to end up with Robin's sister, played by Lucy Hale.
Oh, yeah.
Because
that's
he always talks to his kids about Aunt Robin, and so we always assume that it's like a, you know, really good friend of the family, Aunt Robin. But I wonder if it isn't really Aunt Robin, as in Mom's sister.
That's a good call.
Yeah, right?
But they'll never be as happy as Willow and what's his name from Freaks and Geeks. They're such a good couple.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. I always forget he was in Freaks and Geeks. Jason Segel. Willow? She's not Willow.
Well, she'll always be Willow in Michael's eyes.
Yeah, for somebody who watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Why would you make fun of me for that? That's one of the best shows of all time. I'm
not exaggerating. I totally disagree. It's one of the most overrated shows of all time.
Do you like The Wire?
Can I be a really bad person and say no?
How about this? You want to see a real bad person? I've never seen it.
You've never seen The Wire?
Never seen a single episode.
I saw like the first half of the first season, and I finally gave up because I was so bored. And I know that I'm wrong. I know that it is a really good show, and I am the bad person for not liking it, but I was totally bored.
Well, a show that a lot of people don't necessarily think is good anymore is Scrubs. I happen to like the show. But ABC picked it up for another season. And while Zach Braff is only going to be there for 6 episodes, and Sarah Chalke might only be there for 6 episodes, it looks as if Donald Faison, John C. McGinley, and Neil Finn have closed deals to continue as regulars in second position to their pilots.
I think it was the opposite. I think their pilots are in second position to the show.
Wow.
Which I've never heard of.
No, I've never heard of that either.
Actually, Hollywood Reporter reports that, no pun intended, that they have all closed deals to continue as regulars in second position to their pilots. Faison and Flynn co-star in hot ABC pilots The Law, which is already unofficially staffing, and The Middle, respectively. McGinley is on CBS's drama pilot Back. Meanwhile, Judy Reyes has not been approached for a deal, but may appear as a guest star.
Okay, so I'm wrong. Okay, well, that actually makes much more sense.
But whatever you think of the show, I mean, and I certainly liked it at its beginning. I interviewed Zach Braff. I mean, I thought it was a fun, clever show. It's clearly run its course. I mean, even if you can still enjoy episode to episode, it's over both both ratings-wise and creatively. And it's just sad to see them keep dragging out a few more episodes.
Also, did you see the finale?
I did not.
Neither did I, traveling.
Yeah, I saw like the last 15 minutes of the finale just because it was on before something else I was going to watch. Actually, probably 5 minutes. And it was like, it was behind the scenes of the cast, like saying goodbye to each other. I mean, the show is over.
Did we say goodbye? I meant see you soon.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like see you in a few months.
Well, another show that might be back on, it looks like, is the Gossip Girl spinoff, which I know it does not make you happy, Karen.
No, by the way, it's not the Gossip Girl. It's Gossip Girl.
Gossip Girl. Come on, GG.
The Michael,
pilot
do you
episode.
Watch Gossip Girl?
I dip into it. I don't watch it regularly. I read the books. I read a few of the books to prepare for when the show came out. I could never quite get on the Gossip Girl bandwagon.
Well, I'm completely obsessed. And I watched the show that was going to be, it was acting as the spinoff for, I think we're just going to call it Lily. And yeah. It was awful. It was unwatchably awful.
How was it Britney worse? Stewart. How was it differently bad than the rest of the show?
Well, I think Gossip Girl is a pretty well-written show.
Yeah,
and
people
as much
like
as, like,
it.
Blake Lively and Penn Badgley, I mean, they can't act. There's no question about that. But it's a pretty, it's a well-written show, and it's fun. But yeah. Brittany Snow can't act. Kristen Ritter
Brittany Snow.
Is...
Brittany Snow is...
You disagree with me?
No, not at all.
Yeah, she sucks. And Kristen Ritter, who's clearly the CW really, really likes her from her Gilmore Girls days, I've never understood her. She plays Lily's sister in this, and I find her immensely irritating. And then there's also the guy whose name I can't remember who was in Veronica Mars. He played Dick in Veronica Mars, and he can't act either. So you've got three people who can't act in a show that it's not well-written, and it was just awful.
You know, a show that a lot of people think is... Well written is Bones, and that was picked up.
Yeah, that got picked up after.
That's no surprise.
Yeah, but they had an issue with like license fees or something, and it's like, come on, that really wasn't a surprise.
Yeah, though obviously you've never watched American Dreams, I take it, Karen.
No, I pass. Although that was supposed to be a good show, I know.
Really, really, the first two seasons were just terrific. They rushed it. They panicked in the third season. Oh yeah, she was perfect. It was probably the role of a lifetime for her.
Yeah, I'm just going to say what happened to her acting skills.
Who?
Brittany Snow. She's in the Gossip Girl spinoff, and she was the lead in American Dreams, and she was a delight.
Well, without a doubt, the lead story of this week is going to be that the TV upfronts happened starting on Monday.
Right, which, you know, I've always thought it was kind of fun. But also, the upfronts, you know, I mean, the economy has affected Cannes, it's affected the upfronts as well. They're not flying their actors out anymore, which I find really fascinating. But the big story of the week, TV-wise, is Ben Silverman.
Well, you mean the New York Times story?
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's just kind of a big deal about whether he's going to stay or whether he's going to go, because he's not had a very successful year.
Is there really any debate?
Is there really a debate? I don't know. I mean, I think that personally and professionally, this has been a bad year for him. He's made a lot of stumbles. He's clearly, well, to me, he's clearly just an arrogant ass. But more importantly, his shows haven't done well. And nobody really likes him. They've had to replace his top lieutenant. And Jeff Zucker, has not actually said, yes, we love him, he's coming back. He has said he's had a tough year, but you know, he's learning. But what I think is most interesting is his quote saying, we need better shows. That is a priority number one right now.
Yeah, but you know, he's had 1 year basically. He joined in May of 2007, I think, which means he inherited the last person's shows. So he's had 1 full year to work, and that's just not enough time to develop shows and get something turned around. They fired Susan Lyne, who was the editor of Premiere. They fired her from ABC just as she had finished developing Lost and Grey's Anatomy. So they do this all the time where they give people, you know, a year and a half, and half the time they're just, you know, shepherding through the shows from somebody prior to them, and then they pull the plug on them and kick them out. You've got to have 2-3 seasons of your own before you can be accused of failing or succeeding, and I don't think he's been given a chance.
But this is a guy who greenlit that horrible Christian Slater show, My Own Worst Enemy. I mean, come on, really? Did anybody think that was going to do well?
My friend's in Illinois, and it's doing okay in the UK. It might worldwide, it might make money.
Well, you know, Michael, that's the same story what you were just saying about how you need to give them time, a network head time to develop their own shows. It's the same story with studio executives. The flops that occur under the new any new studio head are always attributed to the last guy, and any successes are always attributed to the new guy, even though the new guy or woman didn't develop them at all.
That's true, and a lot of times people don't want to give a movie they inherit a shot because they figure, well, they won't get any credit for it. So that's been a problem. But I think people got over that. I think people today are a little smarter. They can't throw away, you know, romantic comedies cost $90 million, so you can't just say, oh, I'm going to dump this film. And I think people now recognize that, you know, greenlighting the movie is important, and getting it into the theaters with the right marketing push is important too. So a new guy can get credit for shepherding through a good film that was greenlit by someone else. They're kicking me out of the press room here.
That's one of the glories here of Cannes, is that they, for the journalists, they have a Wi-Fi cafe, which has no food. So I don't know why they call it a cafe, but
Orange.
There's no food. There's coffee, but there's no food. Orange sponsors the Wi-Fi cafe, and they give you free Wi-Fi. But there are so many journalists here, close to 4,000 journalists, that it's really become unbearable to try and work in the Wi-Fi cafe. They're literally journalists dripping off the wall.
There are about maybe 100 seats here, maybe 120, that they can fit people in.
Right, and right now, at 11 o'clock every night, they kick all the journalists out because of some union rule, and we all sit here in the Palais on the steps trying to file our stories.
I'm looking at 15 or 20 people slumped on the ground in a hallway, typing away on their laptop computer. And I'm just, Stephen and Sperling and I are adding two more people. It's pathetic.
But the worst part is that most of the people that are out here and or in the Wi-Fi cafe are all photographers who race back after the red carpet and start uploading these huge files. And then for people like Michael and myself, we can't access anything because they're hogging up all the bandwidth. And right now, Michael Giltz is recording on his flip camera all of the journalists sitting here at 11 p.m. trying to do their work. And he's also recording me. So maybe we'll try and post that on the...
Oh, yeah, let's.
I also have video of a guy with a laptop balanced on a motorcycle out on the Croisette. And he's typing away and filing his story in the middle of the street with his laptop balanced on the motorcycle down by the beach. You work
Welcome
where
to
you,
Cannes.
You can and when you can.
I love that.
Karen, what's the school?
Hulu is kind of a story that's close to Sperling's heart. We manage to talk about it every single week. The latest is that, Sperling, you know this exactly, but it's like cable and satellite operators are starting to get sort of annoyed that they're not making the money that they will make because people are going to Hulu instead. Do I have that right?
Pretty much, yeah. The world is changing, and satellite providers and cable providers are not all that happy about it. There's a story in the LA Times, and online viewership is going through the roof, and media companies are wondering how they're going to keep their revenue up, because...
And as far as I know, nobody really has an answer to this. Michael, what are your thoughts?
I watched Greek the last 3 or 4 weeks. I've been watching Greek on the ABC Family website. And when I'm not doing that, I'm using, what do you call the, not Flipshare, but Slingbox. I've been using Slingbox and Hulu. And I'm almost never watching television live, and none of that gets counted in the ratings. And it's fun, and it's great, and it's neat. But you know what? These shows cost $1 million, $2 million an episode. And if you want them to make it, they're going to have to make money somewhere. And DVD sales isn't going to cut it.
That's what they're saying.
I know. I agree. I don't have an idea for that, though.
I think the one solution is when they figure out the metrics of how to measure online viewership, then they'll be able to have some ads and be able to make more money off of them. Once they're able to correctly tell you how many people are watching this stuff on Hulu and on DVR 1 day and 7 day plus, then they're going to be able to charge more for the ads that they're running.
Because we actually talked about that last week, about Nielsen and ratings and the new way of doing ratings and what some of those ideas might be. I find this fascinating. I've always thought that Nielsen was wrong. And they are going to have to come up with a way to measure people who are watching TV on their DVRs. And I find the whole world is really fascinating.
Yeah, I do too. I'm a Nielsen junkie. Some kids would check the baseball ratings when they were growing up. I would look at the Nielsen statistics.
Right before fall and right before midseason, I sit down with my sister and we block out our viewing schedule for that season. Which is
how
hard.
Oh my God, if we'd been neighbors, we would have been the best friends.
Well, the LA Times had this story. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. It says here that Hulu's traction with users is entrenched entertainment companies worry that the video site's runaway success could undercut the financial underpinnings of the industry. That's correct.
True.
That's all correct.
All right. They are correct. Okay.
It's an interesting article and well worth reading, so we'll put a link to it in the show notes. And there really is no answer that any of us have right now, and if we had it, we'd all be multimillionaires.
Yeah, I'm working on that.
I'm just working on my app still for the iPhone. If I could get that done, that'd be great.
Hey, you know what's going to be on Hulu now? Bollywood films.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I don't care about that.
I'm actually interested by it. I'm looking forward to it.
You watch Bollywood movies?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, why not? Some of them are really good. And just like in the U.S., some of them are really bad.
Michael, do you watch Bollywood movies?
I'm not an expert, but I tend to watch what the biggest hits play in New York at the Imagination Theater. And so I tend to watch what comes there because it's usually the biggest and the best movies of the year. So it's a pretty good judge of the quality of the films. They're always like 3.5 hours long, and they've got great dance sequences. Whatever you thought of Slumdog Millionaire, didn't you love it when they danced at the end?
So, I love that. I know some people didn't. I loved it.
Oh, it's great.
I thought that was the best part of the movie, which I'm not
absolutely
a huge fan.
I'm not either. It was fine, but yeah, that was the best part. Yeah.
Well, it looks like Hulu has struck a deal with Savin, which is a Bollywood distributor, and the head of Savin, Vin Bhatt, says here in Pace magazine, one of Savin's goals is to make Bollywood more accessible to everyone, and by having these films on Hulu, we believe that more people in the U.S. will open up to the genre that is revered by billions around the world. Or at least in India. And that last part's just me.
I was like, yeah, billions minus me.
Which means we'll finally get to see Kissy P.R. Karun on Hulu sometime soon.
All right, final topic, pop culture, the world in pop culture, which is usually, besides TV, my favorite. I've been obsessed with the Elizabeth Edwards book tour this week because I know that her book is called Resilience and supposedly it's about just being resilient with life. But everybody, all the press and she herself does nothing but focus on John Edwards, his lies, his affair, his lies about the affair. And I find the whole thing really rather disgusting.
Wait a second. Elizabeth Edwards, his wife?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's cheated on her and he admits it, so it's not a shock. But writing a book about it and touring to say how bad it is a little weird. It's like, divorce him or don't, but don't write a book about it while you're in the middle of it.
I know, and she's, to her credit, she seems like a really like tough woman and very smart. And I think that what he did was completely inexcusable. But I find it just really unnerving that she is all over the place. She's on Oprah. She's on the Today Show. She seems to be all over the place talking about the fact that her husband lied to her and her husband had an affair and, you know, there was this other woman and she's supposedly doing this for the kid, which I find really ludicrous.
That's
ludicrous.
Ridiculous. That's absurd. I mean, you're not making any excuses for him whatsoever, and it doesn't make them equal in sin. But, you know, obviously he's wrong to cheat on his wife and he's an idiot because he could have been a vice president or presidential nominee. And she's just being not thoughtful about her kids by going to national television repeatedly to talk about it.
She certainly is destroying any hope he ever has of being a politician again.
Well, it was over probably when he had to bow out of the presidential race. And you know what? She invested decades of her life in building him towards that dream and that possibility. And I guess watching him squander it with some, you know, a stupid affair like that, she decided, you know what? I'm done with you.
Yeah, hey. No, this I think is just the ultimate flipping him the bird, which is why I find it, for a woman who's so classy, I find it just an incredibly unclassy move. I mean, but part of me doesn't blame her.
You know what's a really unclassy move? A really unclassy move is...
Yeah, I do blame her.
Is being a paparazzi and stalking Farrah Fawcett as she goes through chemo.
Yeah.
And that's exactly
this truly I find low. So upsetting.
Do you look at the National Enquirer or People Magazine or Star or OK or Hello? Do you look at those magazines that feast on the paparazzi photos?
Yeah, I subscribe to People and Us.
You know where I'm going with this, because I don't, and I don't read the gossip pages, and I...
I wouldn't put People and National Enquirer in the same category. I really wouldn't. Because People seems to have a little bit more of a journalistic integrity. We can chuckle as I say that. But and I also
would not... But they pay half a million. They pay half a million for photos.
Unbelievable.
I know.
Well, I don't know what's worse. The fact that a paparazzi was taking a picture of Farrah Fawcett as she's getting off a plane from getting cancer treatment. Or the fact that somebody at UCLA was... looking into her records and selling the information to the National Enquirer, and then UCLA didn't even bother to own up to it at first. She had to set up her own little sting, or the fact that the National Enquirer would print it in the first place.
Hmm. Well, see, here's my thoughts on that. First of all, the paparazzi, it's their job. I mean, are they scumbags? Yes. But it is public that she's got cancer, and it is part of their job to stalk celebrities. That's an entirely separate issue.
Well, it's someone's job to be a hired assassin.
And the National Enquirer is part of their job to print this stuff. That's what they do. People know that that's what they do. As far as UCLA, I mean, that to me is a criminal offense.
Absolutely.
Well, it would have been a criminal offense, and they were going to file charges against the woman who was dipping in and illegally looking at her medical records, but she passed away from cancer before they had a chance.
Oh, God.
Huh.
So there was a huge story about this in the Los Angeles Times. It was a front page story, a little heartbreaking. Well, a lot heartbreaking, because effectively what they're saying is Farrah Fawcett is dying and she knows it. They've stopped all treatment. She had rectal cancer. And has rectal cancer, and it's recurring, and she has stopped treatment because she just feels like, given
better
what her doctors have said.
I
didn't hear what you just said there, Michael. Can you say that again?
I was just saying that Farrah probably just decided to have quality of life rather than, you know, for the little time she has left, rather than keep going through chemo for something that's pretty hopeless. And I wonder if that woman at UCLA had health insurance. Maybe she was using the money to pay for some of the medical treatment she couldn't afford.
She only got about $4,000 for it.
Well, that's a round of chemo, perhaps.
I think they actually explain why she did it in the article. We'll put a link to it again in the show notes.
Yeah, but you know, let Farrah Fawcett have a little bit of dignity.
I know, because I completely agree. She's 62 years old. She's got cancer. She's admitted she's dying. She did this documentary, which is appearing on, I guess it was on the air last Friday on NBC. And she did this interview in the LA Times last August. So, and only permitted them to publish it when her documentary was being aired.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's a good story. Well written, and it was put together very well. It's a good story journalistically. It's not a good story in terms of the subject matter.
Yeah. I wouldn't let the paparazzi have to go. I mean, it is their job, but it's also someone's job to sell crack cocaine to school children. It doesn't mean they should do it. Well, actually, there should be better stalking laws in the states. They should not be able to shoot you when you're in your home. Or, you know, minors, they shouldn't be able to shoot minors, the children of celebrities, and follow them around. I think more of it should be illegal, and I think there's perfectly reasonable limits to be placed on them without, you know, stopping our right to find out who Chase Crawford is dating.
Oh, well, I don't disagree. I do not disagree. But if you are a celebrity and you're in public, that's fair game. So taking a picture of Farrah Fawcett at the airport is fair game.
It's constitutional, but it's creepy.
Oh, God, if we get into this creepy whole thing right now, we're never going to have an ending to
this. All right, all
right. Well, you know, as we talk about this whole paparazzi thing, we're surrounded by about 50 photographers in their tuxedos who probably about 40 minutes ago were all screaming the name of Rachel Weisz as she walked up the red carpet.
Which
we're probably
going to
get Michael and I are probably going to get jumped as we walk home down the Quasette tonight by some tuxedoed photographers. So Karen, if you never hear from us again, look,
I'll find a new co-host for the podcast.
Oh, well, at least we know where we stand.
But that's a photo call. That's an event designed to promote the movie, and they're there dressed to the nines to be photographed. It's different from when they go to the grocery store, when they can't go to the grocery store or take their kid to school without having 10 people stand outside the door and take shots of them every day.
I agree that it sucks, but it's what you get into when you are a celebrity. I don't think it's right for them to be filming them inside their homes. That's private property. But if you were at the grocery store, yes, it sucks, but yes, it's also part of what you have signed on to do.
Not to backtrack to television, but isn't Jay Leno's last show this week?
Oh, in the old, as the Tonight Show host?
Yes.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, I don't watch Leno. That's up past, that requiring me to be up past my bedtime.
That's
but I don't
right,
know.
I forgot you're not a late night television girl.
No.
Well, I believe Conan O'Brien was booked to appear on it, and of course he's taking over the Tonight Show gig.
No, Jay Leno's last show is May 29th, and then Conan O'Brien jumps in right after that. And then Jay starts in the fall with his 10 p.m. show nightly on ABC. And the best late night talk show host,
okay,
if you're
Jay
wondering, is Craig Ferguson. Yes.
I
well,
like
you know what?
Which means?
How we agree on something.
We have a million stories we could talk about here, including Jerry Lewis's planned comeback. He's coming to Cannes to announce his comeback in some movie. He's 83 years old and he wants to make a serious drama so he could go out and win that Oscar. But I think we've come to the end of our show here.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, remember,
thanks for
we've been
me on
trying
the show
to make this a reasonable length.
Finally. I think we're finally getting the hang of this, and I say that every week, but I really think this time I mean it. And next week I'll mean it even more. Now, if you want to read some of Michael's writings, of course, you can find them on Huffington Post. Is there anything else you want to plug, Michael?
You can go to michaelgilt.com for an archive of thousands of my articles, or Pop Surfing, which is my website where I link to my latest articles wherever they appear. And I'll be covering Cannes for Huffington and The Advocate.
And if you want links to any of the stories we talked about on this show, you can go to showbizsandbox.com. and get them there. Of course, you can also find links to all of our multiple social networking sites, including Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook. And
wow, can I get a date on that?
A date on Facebook?
Well, all your social networking stuff.
I think it's more for professional purposes.
All right.
Yeah,
it's
no,
not MySpace.
Dating site. It's not MySpace.
If you want to email us, you can do so, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and tell us what you think of the podcast, or send us stories or comment on stories. We hope to be reading some of your emails when we start getting them on the show itself. You can also call us. The number I completely forget.
No, I've got it. It's 1-888-567-SAND, which is 7263.
Awesome.
Does that actually work?
Yeah, I don't know. We should probably check that.
We haven't received a phone call yet, so
well,
maybe
I'll
that's
call
why.
You.
Oh, yeah, please do.
Somebody should call. Even if they're going to yell at us, I wouldn't mind if they called and said we were the biggest morons on the face of the planet. And please don't call us and tell us that, but if they did, we'd probably play it, because it would be the only voicemail we would receive.
Yeah, that'd be fun. We would definitely play that.
But if you want to comment on any of the stories via voicemail, feel free to give us a call. And Michael, thank you very much for joining us. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks again.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
See you next week. Play nice.